Hello, and welcome to A History of Japan. Season 5, Episode 7, The Taira and Minamoto Clans. In the previous episode, we discussed how Emperor Saga demoted 32 of his children from being official members of the royal family to being just plain nobility. People often get the wrong impression about what this demotion actually meant, picturing teary-eyed, illegitimate children being cast into the street into a life of squalor and poverty. However, being members of the noble caste was far better than being a commoner, and held more than a few advantages unavailable to the average Japanese resident. Being nobility meant that they could apply for a post in the imperial bureaucracy or seek higher office in the provinces. They could attend the Daigaku, the imperial university, perhaps become an advisor to the very emperor who had just demoted them. There were a number of benefits available to the nobility of the Heian period, and tears for the unfortunate are best saved for the poorer workers in the rice paddies who had to plow and tend their fields by hand. All it really meant was that they would no longer get a massive free supply of rice and food supplied by the imperial treasury. Those children of Emperor Saga who had been ejected from the family were referred to as the Minamoto, or Genji, two interchangeable terms which use the same kanji. Other emperors in the future would also demote swaths of their children and grandchildren, and most of them are referred to by the surname of the emperor from whom they descend, followed by Genji. Thus, Emperor Saga's surplus offspring were called the Saga Genji. For clarity's sake, I'll try to use the name Minamoto when referring to all of the Minamoto, regardless of which emperor spawned them, and use the more specific Genji name when we're discussing a particular branch of the Minamoto clan. We'll start with the Saga Genji, being the first among many future Minamoto. Several Minamoto of this particular branch did well for themselves, particularly Makoto, Tokiwa, Sadamu, and Toru. All of them spent their lives serving in high positions within the Daijo Daikan, most serving as counselors at some point, and many reaching the rank of Sadaijin, Minister of the Left, with Minamoto Sadamu even serving as Chancellor, or Dainagon, the highest position available to nobility. Like many of the other Heian Kuge, they wrote poetry, and Minamoto Toru is even believed to be the basis of the character Genji Hikaru in The Tale of Genji, a work we will discuss in greater detail next season. While the Saga Genji would prove very successful at maintaining their noble status, their efforts would be eclipsed by the Seiwa Genji, the Minamoto clan who descended from Emperor Seiwa. The Seiwa Genji came along much later in the Heian period and won't appear in the narrative until the end of this current season, but much of what we will discuss next season will involve Seiwa Genji samurai like Minamoto Tsunemoto and the powerful future shogun Minamoto Yoritomo. I don't want to spoil too many future events, but the Seiwa Genji would achieve such legendary status in the minds of future generations that many of the later samurai clans who came to dominate the nation would proudly proclaim their descent from the demoted offspring of Emperor Seiwa. There were many other such Genji clans, one for nearly every emperor of the early Heian period. While the early Minamoto tended toward rising through the aristocracy of the capital, the Taira clan was a bit different. Taira was another honorific surname granted to the descendants of emperors. Taira itself is a single kanji, so the phrase Taira clan is a compound of two kanjis pronounced as Heishi, and the phrase Taira house is thus pronounced Heike. I will henceforth use just plain Taira or Taira clan for the sake of clarity. The emperors from whom the Taira descended were Kammu, Nimmyo, Montoku and Kōko, respectively. Those descended from Emperor Kammu, referred to collectively as the Kammu Heishi, became the dominant line of the Taira clan. While the Minamoto tended to be the direct offspring of emperors, the name Taira was usually conferred on grandchildren and other more distant descendants who had previously been considered still part of the royal family. While the Minamoto usually acquired fairly high-ranking court appointments, the Taira were generally expected to seek their fortunes in the lower ranks of the bureaucracy. This limited potential for advancement led many Taira members to seek employment in provincial governments instead. Many gravitated toward the rich rice lands of Kanto, which gradually became a common destination for younger sons of the general nobility, as well as the outright illegitimate who had no expectation of inheritance. While the imperial court's war against the Eimishi had officially ended in 811, this did not mean that the indigenous people of Tohoku had all laid down their arms and become docile subjects. The execution of Aterui by the court had hardened a number of the independent clans, and while they may not have had the ability to drive the Yamato Japanese out of their land entirely, they could certainly raid the smallholders that dotted the Kanto. As the 800s progressed, rice production was gradually shifted from state-controlled allotted fields farmed by common subjects to the Shōen estates, which continued to expand in spite of the court's efforts to limit their growth. Provincial officials were still expected to collect a certain amount of food via tax tribute, and those officials steadily came to rely on armed guards to protect them and enforce the status quo against the increasingly discontented farmers. Likewise, the Shōen in Kanto needed soldiers to protect its boundaries against not only Eimishi raiders, but also bands of outlaws which grew more numerous and more bold with each passing year. The court's never-ending struggle to collect enough tax revenue to fund the government reached a new measure of coercive desperation by the early 900s. It had been the job of district magistrates to collect tax tribute in grain and other long-lasting foodstuffs on behalf of the court. But a declining population meant lower yields for the farms, which meant that the margin collected by the government might very well mean the difference between life and death for the communities, and even the magistrates and their families. Divine fires would sometimes strike the government storehouses, burning the structures to the ground and destroying the precious tax grains within. At least, that was the story the local magistrates told the men from Heian-kyo who had come to take the taxes back to the capital. In reality, they hid the precious grain somewhere else and set fire to the empty storehouse. Such theatrics did not fool the court for long, and in response they encouraged the lower nobility to compete with one another for provincial jobs. In the Asuka period of the 5 and 600s, Japan was defined by strong hereditary provincial nobility whom the court was determined to bring under their authority. In the Nara period, they largely succeeded in this objective as the provincial aristocracies came to view their official court titles as part of their legitimacy in local rule. Opening those offices to competition probably seemed like a good idea to those who think that competition solves everything. But evidence suggests that this resulted in ultimately weakening the government's grasp on the distant provinces. In his excellent book, Japan to 1600, A Social and Economic History, Dr. William Wayne Ferris writes, "The long-term result was to demean and weaken the court's age-old supporters at a time when they were already facing economic challenges." Ultimately, the old system prescribed in the Taiho Code collapsed. Every step in the taxation process, from census to allotment to collection and enforcement, had practically fallen apart by the 900s. I mentioned previously that the Honden Shujo system was abandoned wholesale during this time, but this was more of an acknowledgement of reality than a conscientious choice. The court was contracting, leaving more offices vacant in order to keep the national coffers in the black. Provincial governors who, at this point, were capital appointees from families without close ties to those they were governing, were given a new incentive to ensure that revenue stayed healthy. The court allowed them to become tax farmers. Essentially, the governors were given a set amount which they were expected to deliver to the capital once during their 4-year terms. Anything they collected over that quota was theirs to keep. You might imagine that these governors spent as much time as they could in their province, ensuring that production stayed as high as possible and dispensing justice wherever it was needed. But you would be wrong. Most governors lived in the capital for the majority of their 4 years in office, usually traveling to their province only once during their term. The day-to-day operations were left up to the lower provincial officials and the agents they relied upon to collect their tribute, plus their tax farming bonus. Who were these agents who collected the grain and enforced their employers' wills by the point of a sword and the tip of an arrow? Many were among the Tyra clan at first, but other armed groups formed and offered services to the tax-farming governors. Lower-ranking Minamoto, who were unable to gain a government appointment in the capital, also made their way to the wealthiest farming provinces, particularly those of the fertile Kanto Plain. These repressive measures by the court did little to engender loyalty, trust, or appreciation from the common farmers, who now found themselves victims of government-approved raids. Absconding peasants had been a problem before. Next season, we will see how the growing Shoans benefited as disillusioned commoners sought refuge among wealthy landowners who began to gather their own groups of armed men to keep the agents of the tax farmers out, one way or another. While this pattern of transformation was taking place all over Japan throughout the 800s, it's worth noting that places in western Japan like Kyushu and Chugoku were also struggling against continual epidemics as well. The Kanto in the east was the primary location where these armed groups formed protective confederations against greedy government agents and trained in horse-mounted warfare, especially mounted archery. We'll discuss the rise of the samurai in greater detail toward the end of this season, and indeed the samurai will take center stage in the late Heian and for hundreds of years thereafter. The Taira and Minamoto clans, after all, were not just warriors, but noble descendants of illustrious emperors. While their forebears may have been cast out of the circle of legitimate heirs, in a very real way, they will eventually undo the work of the imperial court and forge their own right to rule. Next time, we'll return to the narrative and focus especially on the rise of a Kuge clan whose ascendancy defined the Heian period, both its triumphs and its mistakes. I am referring, of course, to the Fujiwara clan. Until then, you can follow the podcast on Twitter at A History of Japan. Visit the online store, ahistoryofjapan.threadless.com, and find us on the web, ahistoryofjapan.com.